Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This time, I'm interviewing Gloria Vanderhorst, and her miracle this week, I just sat back and listened in awe. Yes, another story from someone where I just got to peek a little bit further behind the curtain of the magic and the mystery that is the universe. It did take place when Gloria was a child, and, you know, her telling of it, despite the passage of time, is still fresh and powerful and groundbreaking. So I can't wait for you to hear her tale. But Gloria herself is a psychologist, writer, advisor, and mentor, and really now is concentrating her practice on helping men explore their emotional angst. She wants to help men access feelings that have been blocked from early childhood. And she's really working on helping men develop broader, healthier relationships with their spouses and families. She works with internal family systems and emotion-focused therapy. And all in all, I think she's onto something. And you'll hear it in our conversation later, because we do get into the work that she's doing amidst, you know, our conversation around mathematics and what happened to Gloria as a child, and how she too, when she was a kid, got to peek behind the curtain of the mystery that is the universe. But I'll let Gloria tell that tale. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Gloria Vanderhorst.
She took me to the doctor. My mother and father together took me to the doctor. And the doctor was a long-term friend of the family. So he spent maybe 2 seconds examining me, walked into the next room, and you could hear his phone call. He called the emergency room and he says, "I'm sending you a dead one. Do the best you can." So I would introduce myself as a psychologist, right? And then I would tell the story of how I got there, because I did not start out with any desire to be a psychologist at all. I wanted to be a math teacher. I loved math. I was good at math. I was going to be a high school math teacher. And I was on track to, I had a goal I set for myself. I wanted to graduate from college in 3 years, not 4. Right? I wanted to be ahead of everybody else at the front of the line. And I wanted to do it with a 4.0. And I was on track to accomplish that. Right? I was at the end of my second year. I had a 4.0. And I had a teacher for calculus 2 who was unusual. She was brand new to teaching. She faced the blackboard and wrote with her right hand, erased with her left hand, and never turned around to the class. She spoke to the blackboard, right? And I'm serious. She filled the front blackboard top to bottom, top to bottom. She filled the side blackboard top to bottom, top to bottom. Never turned around and spoke to the class. She spoke to the blackboard. Everyone was lost, right? I got an A in calculus 1, right? Here I am in calculus 2, which I think will be a breeze. I don't understand a word of it, right? I'm like totally lost. Everybody else in the class is totally lost. We're trying to meet and help each other. So it's time to go home for Christmas. I'm on the bus. I send a friend to go check her door where she is posting the grades, right? My friend comes running across the parking lot screaming, "You got a D, you got a D." And I went, "Yes, I passed calculus 2. I never have to take it again." And my minor at that point was psychology. And over Christmas break, I just said, "I'm flipping those suckers, right? I'm going to be a math minor and a psychology major." I was having fun in psychology. It was a break from the rigors of math. So I flipped those. And only much, much later, I would say years later, did I realize the power of the intervention that turned me into a psychologist rather than a math teacher. It is my calling. I have loved it, right? I've been doing it for 50 years. I have no vision of stopping. I love what I do, but I never would have chosen it for myself, right? I had to hit a wall. I had to be smashed in the face with, "You are not going to be a math teacher," right? And that flip was just perfect, right? And it was easy from that point forward to embrace this profession and to love every minute of it. So that's how I got into psychology.
I have to tell you that I have questions, okay?
Yeah, sure.
And one of them
fire
is...
Fire away.
So one of them is, did you realize quite early on that you had an affinity for math?
Oh, yes. I loved math, right? I love math. It was easy for me.
Wow.
Maybe I loved it because of that, because it was so easy.
Well, I only ask because when I was in, and I've mentioned this before, when I was in math in high school, you know, trig, algebra, blah, 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 all mm-hmm. that stuff. What I really appreciated about it was there were rules. And, you know, you follow the rules. If you follow the rules, you get the right answer. But then, you know, when I tested for college, Champaign-Urbana said, "Hey, you got to take algebra over again." So I went and I took algebra in college, and it was a very different kind of algebra than I took in high school. And I was rubbish. I could not understand what I was like, this is a world that I can't even comprehend. This is not even what they taught me in high school. I was at sea. I was lost. I got a terrible grade. I could not comprehend how it was so different. You know, it was grown up algebra versus high school right. algebra. I want to ask you, so do you think that it was primarily the teacher's way of conveying the information that, I mean, it sounds like the rest of the class was struggling too.
Everybody was struggling. I think it was somewhat that style of hers, right? But I think it was also what you experienced, right? Which it was like a completely different language, right? I mastered the language up until this point, and then somebody changed the rules.
Yeah.
Right. Somebody changed the language and it didn't make any sense to me. I really could not follow it at all. And, you know, I have a 4.0 at that point. I'm a real serious student. I didn't slack off. Right. I dove into trying to figure this stuff out. And it was a mystery to me. I just couldn't do it.
Part of what I really love about math, and we're just going to do a little side thing here, is that, okay, so what's glorious about it is that there are rules, right? But so much of math is a mystery still. And right. inside the math, that is very exciting to me. And, you know, math isn't just numbers. It's also, and I'm not sure if I'm using this word correctly, but it's topographical in that when you get a bunch of numbers together, sometimes they create shapes.
Right. Yeah,
and people don't understand why that happens. And that is thoroughly exciting, I think.
Right. I have to tell you a story about my own daughter. Right. She's in third grade. Right. And she is asking the teacher, when it comes to math, so many questions. Why does it work? All right. The teacher just wants you to memorize the multiplication tables. Right. And she's asking, why does it work? I don't understand why it works. Show me how it works. I mean, she's asking tons of questions about the essence of math. Right. And the teacher is irritated at her because the teacher can't explain it. Right. And so she comes home and, you know, here I am, a former math major. I still say I like math. And so we start doing all kinds of things so that she can see it and feel it. Right. Beans, apples, tearing up paper. I mean, we did so many things to try to understand why it works. And that's really what you're talking about, right? We can learn something or we can understand something. And I think the purpose of therapy is to understand. It isn't to learn something. It is to really understand your history, how that has impacted you, how that has shaped you, how it's put limits and fences out there for you so that you can make choices about what do I want to create for myself, what I want to experience, and then take up the challenge to learn those things, to step in that direction, and to facilitate making modifications in how you were taught. Because we were taught to behave, to think, to express, right? Our personalities have lots of shaping in them from the people that raised us and everybody that we interacted with. So it's very much like the math story.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, I've heard so many stories of inconvenient children and their questions, right. You know, whether it's in a place of worship or the classroom. Sometimes people don't like that. Well, what I really love about math is that it exists in several different ways, right? We can talk about, and I want to ask, I'm going to tie this into the work that you do. So math is in the world, right? And we can write it down. And then people can go to the limits of it and see if there are other ways to explain what's going on in the world. So we have, you know, pencil in hand, paper, you can write math down and know that there are some truths in there. But then math also exists in the world three-dimensionally, which is absolutely fascinating. We just don't think about it as we're moving through the world.
Right.
And so the work that you do, which I find beautiful and fascinating, is, you know, we can all tell ourselves stories, right, about who we are, and they become our truth. We can write them down in our journals. This is me. This is what I experienced. But then also we're carrying those stories into three-dimensionally into the world because we're interacting with those stories and those narratives informing us and maybe governing our responses, poking us and saying, let's react instead of acting consciously. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, with the work that you do and that you engage in, there are multiple things going on. And it's not all just, oh, read a self-help book and you'll be fine.
Right.
Coming to consciousness about the way we move in the world can be a very painful process.
Right. Right. And it can happen at any point in your life as well. I will tell you a very important story about me. Right. So, and I've always, until this last year, looked at this story from the perspective of my mother. So when I was born, my mother in 1946 was in labor for 2 days, which was not that unusual, right? They just let women labor until they delivered a baby. And so she delivered a baby and she didn't see me because she was so exhausted, right? That they just took her away and they took me away. So she had no interaction with me as a baby until the next day. And it's 1946, all right? Women are in a maternity ward, right? Dozen beds, curtains between, and the nurses are bringing babies from the nursery and distributing them to everybody. Babies are wrapped up. So my mother unwraps me and starts screaming. Now, I have a birth defect, which she wasn't aware of, right? Nobody told her. So she starts screaming for the nurse. She's screaming for the doctor. And I have heard this story. She told this story to me not too long before the end of her life. Right, as happens quite frequently as people get older and are facing death, they begin to disclose more. And so she told me this story. I have always had the strongest empathy for her, felt really sorry for her. I never once thought of that experience from the perspective of the infant. But we know infants are brilliant. Right? The only survival mechanism that an infant has is emotional intelligence. They are emotionally brilliant. And so in my own therapy work, right, I was encouraged to think about that from the perspective of me, the infant, right? And suddenly I realize that the reason that I tended to be kind of shy and withdrawn, kind of waiting for things to unfold before I made any moves, was really based in that experience, right? It had to be terrifying for me to have my first interaction with her to be this intense, screaming, you know, just wild woman experience. And so that taught me, be careful, right? Interacting with people. Be careful. Just wait. Hold back. You know, don't let anybody know you're there. And with that understanding, it has freed me up to, well, to do what I'm doing now, right? This is something I never would have done before. I would not have taken the risk of putting myself on the podcast in front of other people, right? Unless you had interviewed me 15 times, right? Before going live.
I think it's really interesting that you bring this up because I was born in 71 and they did C-sections on my mom because mm-hmm. her hips were too narrow to deliver babies. Mm-hmm. And immediately, you know, they said, breast milk is no good. It isn't nourishing. You need to be on formula. So I right. never got fed breast milk ever. And so, and now, of course, we know that a vaginal birth like gives you all sorts of biota that you need and for your immune system. And then breast milk also gives you all of these things that you need for your immune system. I got none of that. So it's really interesting to see how things have shifted and changed as far as giving birth. But right. I think we cannot overstate enough or emphasize enough the nourishment that is shared between a child and the mother. Right. And that it should be two ways mm-hmm. and how even as literally you're a newborn, you're looking for nourishment. You've right. reconnect
connection. Right.
Yes. Yep. With this you body that you've been in for 9 months.
right? Yes. You're born connected and you seek it for the rest of your life.
I think there are a lot of us out there that are looking for, you know, that kind of maternal connection. And what does that look like? And where can we find it? Mm-hmm. What I find fascinating about you is that a lot of people would look at math and look at psychology and say, oh, you know what? Aren't you using two different parts of your brain for this? Because there is this generalization about math being, I think it's right-brained, and psychology is a realm where you probably talk to people about their dreams, about their experiences, how they internalize, maybe do some, I see you do family systems, you know, just making these connections, which some people could classify as a left brain operation,
right?
You could. But you seem to have these, you're like both sides of your brain are excelling. I just want to just note that.
Well, it takes both, right, in order to be successful. And yes, a lot of these early memories are definitely stored in ways that we don't have immediate access through language. Because we hold information in terms of language, in terms of shape, and in terms of experience, right? And so those other two, language is easy to access, but in terms of nonverbal experiences, it's difficult to access things that have been packaged in that way, because we're not used to accessing the nonverbal parts of ourselves. We're very verbal, and that part is easy. But so much of our history is contained more in terms of visual image and touch, so that if we can access the visual, and that was the key to my understanding my birth story, was to see it, right? And to see it from my perspective, not her perspective, and to feel it, right? To feel the fear that would have come up naturally in an infant when your mother is screaming. So we, in order to heal from early experiences, and we all have early experiences that have in some way influenced us, if not traumatized us, but to have access to them, we do have to tap into that sense of just feeling it and touching it and understanding it in ways that language was not accessible to us. We have all of these opportunities to tap into earlier experiences if we can temporarily let go of language in order to do it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I want to ask you something. When your mother divulged this information to you, I can imagine it first, and I'm also projecting onto you because I had an experience like this recently with my mother. You know, was it a little bit difficult to take in and understand? And then later, did you see it for the gift that it was? Because it facilitated your own reconciliation of what happened when you were so little?
So when she told me this, I was immediately empathetic with her, right? So I had had a child of my own, and I think that facilitated the empathy. So I could imagine her being in that situation and how terrifying it would be, right, to be shocked, because you're expecting to enjoy, right? You're expecting to unwrap this little baby and love it and admire it and think every little part of its body and all of its toes and fingers are just the cutest thing ever. That's what you're expecting. So when she did tell me this, I had the greatest degree of empathy for her. And I think in part, that's why I could not see it from my perspective. I could only experience it from, boy, that if that had happened to me, how horrible that would be. You know, the trigger for kind of seeing it in the other direction was just being confronted with, well, what do you think that was like for you? Never thought of it.
Yeah.
Right. Never spent time reflecting it or searching it. I just had this empathy for my mother.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for that. It was a different time. I'm just thinking about your mother giving birth, you know, alone, probably surrounded by, well, maybe a nurse or two, but men, doctors, right. all sorts right. of things, and how isolating and lonely that right. was.
And just think of, you know, 2 days of labor. I mean, come on, give me a break.
Yeah. That's, I actually can't imagine that. God.
So you know it's a male-dominated system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Because yeah. there is no empathy and there is no identification. It is just, this is your job, all right? This is your fate in life. You are to produce children. And hey, if it's painful, if it takes you 2 or 3 days to do it, if you're totally exhausted, so what?
I'm glad that we've moved beyond that. But, you know, there is still work to be done. God. Well, I'd love to ask you the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, what did that look like? And then has that connection to source or spirit, if you have it, has it changed or evolved in what ways?
I did grow up in a religious household. And I would say that my parents were religious because of the neighbors. There was a lovely family that lived behind us across the alley. They had 5 children. And so they were, they might have been 5 to 10 years older than my parents. And they were religious. And they engaged my parents in going to the same church. We went to a Methodist church. And my mother was a nurse. And so she was infrequent in church because she was a private duty nurse, which meant she stayed with a case every day. She didn't get a day off until the case finished. And so she would often work on Sundays. And so my dad was the one who took us. I participated in youth group. I went to, you know, Christian camps in the summertime. And at one of those camps in middle school, had my own conversion experience. And then kind of, I would say maybe it was after marriage that I developed more curiosity and more interest and engaged in an organization called Bible Study Fellowship, which is a women's organization and a men's, but it's a teaching organization that just does Bible study throughout the 9 months of the year. And I did that for years and became a leader of one of the groups in that, as you do if you keep doing it for years. and really educated myself. I learned a ton in that. I've been very active in the church up until recently. Right. And I would say at this time, I'm searching, not committed, but really searching for a place that can nurture me, that can feed me.
nourishment. We all need more of it.
We do.
Yes. Thank you for that beautiful answer. I think, you know, quite honestly, and I don't know why this is, many of the people I interview are searching. I think this is a moment in time where things are evolving and changing and shifting with religions worldwide. And I think people are looking for, you know, leaders who have integrity. I think they're starting to rely on their own hearts for communion and reconciliation with what it is beyond. But they also long for community and belonging, which is also another way to nourish ourselves. So searching can be very scary, but it also can be very exciting. So,
I think there comes a time when it's absolutely necessary if you really want to grow. All right. There's a layer of church involvement and membership that is committed to the organization and the institution, but not necessarily engaged in spiritual growth. Right. And I want to keep growing.
Beautiful. That's really beautiful. Yes. I mean, if you're alive, I would hope that every single person just wants to keep growing, because it's such a dynamic and inspired process. And if you're not, you are stagnant and static, which I think is actually an anti, like, that is not what this universe is about. This universe is about revolution and change and always moving towards something. I wanted to just ask you, now we talked about just earlier, you referenced the patriarchy in regards to your mother, your birth, mm-hmm. that process. And I want to just touch on and talk about the work that you do now with men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to ask you this question. Do you think or know or suspect that patriarchy itself is why men close off their feelings, close themselves off to true connection with others? I'm curious how you feel about that.
The way that I see it, right, is that closing off feeling was at some point adaptive and necessary. If you go back to the caveman, I want a caveman, right, who will pick up his spear, tap into his courage and his strength, both physical and emotional strength, and go out of the cave to face animals that will kill him if he doesn't kill them, right? And I want him to kill animals and bring them back so that in front of the fire, they can be cooked. So I can be fed and my children can be fed. So it was adaptive. And that kind of kept moving forward as well, because we spend human men in conflict, right? We don't send a mixture of men and women. We send men. Right? We have lost so much brain power in the course of going to war that, you know, who knows what we could have become as a world, right? If we hadn't killed them all off. But we take the best of them and kill them off. And so we've created an environment, an earth, in which cutting off access to the more tender range of emotion is guaranteed, right? You have to do it for safety and survival. The interesting part about human males is it has not changed one iota the emotional capability that they're born with. And you've got to wonder about that, right? if for centuries I cut off access to the tender range of emotions, why wouldn't that just kind of drop out of your brain? It has never dropped out of the male brain, right? They come into the world with a broader range of emotional expression than females have. I'm going to say that again. Men come into the world with a broader range of emotional expression than females. All right. They are more intense on the positive end. They are more intense on the negative end. They have greater access to feelings than women do. That has never disappeared for them. That's wild, right? That's kind of blow your mind wild. So it must be important because it's never been drummed out of them over centuries. So it's still there. The hope that I have and that many other people have, because there are now numerous books on the market about fathering boys and about men having access to their feeling states. There are male organizations that have developed that are all across the United States with this intent to educate men on how to access that range of feeling experiences and to embrace it and be comfortable with it. So there's a trend happening, but at the same time, from my perspective, it's moving too slowly, right? Yeah. I see us at risk with the advent of artificial intelligence and how it will take over numerous jobs. We're going to have more opportunity to interact with each other. And if the male isn't helped to access the full range of their feeling states, then we're all going to be in trouble. Our jails are full of men, not women. They're full of men because men don't have access to the full range of feelings. They cannot articulate what they are experiencing from an emotional perspective, so they act on it rather than talking about it. And when they act on it, right, they're being physical, they're creating harm, they're doing things that are dangerous and risky, right? And then we put them in jail for doing those things, right? We don't retrain them. We could, but we don't. We instead spend billions of dollars housing and feeding them rather than re-educating them. But, you know, so that's my soapbox.
I love that soapbox. I love listening to you. Just to let you know, makes me really happy. I think about, you know, a couple things come to mind. I think about, I was an English major in college and, you know, read the Iliad, the Odyssey, all of these things. And over the millennia since caveman days, our societies have been fed the story of going out, conquering the world, fighting war. This is what a true man does. This is what a man who's connected to the soul of the world does, is to fight and adventure. And so we have been fed those stories. I think it's fascinating because evolution, you know, if something's not used, evolution gets rid of it.
Yeah, so I know.
Very telling. And then you've just answered a question for me, because I dated a gentleman for 5 years. He was Catholic, very sensitive, very thoughtful. But I could tell at some level he did not like me. He would say, I love you, but he did not like me. And I knew it was because I had an affinity for Mother Mary. And I really, you know, I would have dreams. I would have what I would classify as visitations, where I felt the glimmering or the shimmering of her presence. And I knew he didn't like me because I could access or have contact with that ineffable presence, which for me just seemed very intuitive and natural. And, you know, it was out there, but it was also within me. It was like finding this place of connection. And I now know that he didn't like me because I feel like he is in the society of the US and could not go to this place of vulnerability, of being, having his heart wide open. And he was upset or angry with me that I could do that. And society, you know, he didn't feel like he could. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. All right. And what I would say to you is the anger, the upset is a secondary emotion. All right. And so what you're saying is that he could not go to the primary emotion, which might have been confusion, even interest. It could have been fear, right? There are primary emotions underneath that. And if he could have presented the primary emotion to you, life would have been very different for the two of you, right? But he couldn't, right? Because we don't allow our boys and men to go to the primary emotion. We do allow them to go to the secondary emotion, which is defensive, irritated, angry, right? Those are to cover up the fact that I'm uncomfortable going to the primary emotion, which is, you know, I'm confused by that, right? I'm scared of that even. Right. Or maybe even I'm suspicious of that. Is it possible that you're just crazy rather than having real experiences? Right. And so he can't go to the primary emotion. So he presents the secondary emotion, which is distancing always. Right. The secondary emotion is always pushing the other person away.
That is fascinating. And also, I think, really lonely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I mean, so isolating. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine. Wow. It's almost like this catch 22 where, you know, they can't go to that primary emotion. So they retreat. But then because they retreat, they can't ever access what needs to be dealt with.
Right. They miss the opportunity. And that's why I like some of these men's organizations that are developing across the United States, where they're really bringing men into groups to talk about their feelings, to really introduce them to the full range of emotional experience, and to have people come and talk to them and present their research to them about how important it is to access the full range of emotions.
Yeah, this is fascinating because I always think about Genesis and the passage where they say man's supposed to have dominion over the, you know, animals. And and I feel like that if men really got in touch with their inner selves, their, you know, their emotions, their compassionate, deeply sensitive selves, they might actually have a, it might open them to different experience for what dominion looks like. Right. With the earth and the animals. It might be a more tender engagement, a more respectful engagement with the world. And I feel like there are some powers that be that don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, because that would strengthen the human being completely. All right. When men, and I believe they will, learn to have access to the full range of feeling states, there's incredible power in that. Just mind-blowing power in that.
Oh, Gloria, thank you. You're just this incredible human. Okay, let me ask you the main question of the podcast. I would so appreciate if you would share, you can share more than one story, just whatever comes to your mind about something that you felt was magical, miraculous, maybe even mysterious. I have had every story you could ever imagine under the sun, all to say that it's all legitimate. It's all legitimate. So whatever you'd like to share.
All right. So I will tell you about me in kind of probably mid-elementary school. I do not remember the exact grade or age. I might have been second or third grade. And as I said, my mother's a nurse, right? So she must go to work. And I woke up not feeling well. And I didn't have a high fever. And so I went to school and my mother went to work. And the neighbors that lived behind us, she was the backup for mother if we were sick or needed to be picked up from school. So somewhere in the late morning, I needed to be picked up from school because my fever had increased. And so Mrs. Sprunger picked me up from school, put me comfortably in her dining room on her daybed, and my fever proceeded to increase and increase and increase and increase. And when my mother came home from work, she took me to the doctor. My mother and father together took me to the doctor. And the doctor was a long-term friend of the family. So he spent maybe 2 seconds examining me, walked into the next room, and you could hear his phone call. He called the emergency room, and he says, "I'm sending you a dead one. Do the best you can." Right? My appendix had broken earlier in the day. Right? And so my father drove like a madman to the emergency room after hearing this message. They whisked me into the ER and took out whatever they could. Right? And that night, my mother went home, and somewhere in the middle of the night, my room fills with this gorgeous light. I mean, it's just such a beautiful light. It is bright, but it doesn't hurt your eyes, right? It is just gorgeous. And there is a being standing over me. And this being moves hands across my body, and I fall back to sleep. And when my mother shows up at 7 that morning, my entire body is covered with black and brown gunk. So whatever they could not sponge out of my cavity was actually lifted out of my cavity. And so here I am, right? I don't die. I live, right? But because of a spiritual being creating that healing.
I have to tell you that while you were telling this story, I was getting goosebumps and then teared up a little bit, because what a powerful affirmation as a child. I mean, what a gift to have that experience and then be able to carry that knowing through your life, that there are beings that want the best for us, that are right, that are present to us, that can grace us with their presence and be of service. What did your mother think? Did you ever tell her what happened?
I actually, as a child, did not. All right. I didn't know what to think about it. And honestly, I was still not feeling well.
Yeah.
Right. I just, you know, I wanted something to eat. I remember that. Wanted something to eat. But all the rest of it, No.
Because I would think a little bit, she'd be like, what is all this weird stuff all over my daughter's body?
She was just delighted. I mean, she was just grateful that somehow it had burst, will, and just, come out all over.
You know, one of the things I think is that you were saved for very many things, but also so in the future you would do this work with men and their sensitive emotional selves. You're like at the vanguard along with other people, because we do need a lot of people to engage and suggest this other way of being to men, other way of being in the world. The other thing I think is I would suspect, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would suspect that it has changed your life forever, because you have touched or been touched by the infinite or by that we cannot name. And as you got older, did it become a touchstone for you to lean back on, to remember the goodness in the world?
I think it clearly has been, right? And that I know that I'm here for a purpose. And so just continuing to do the work that I do is important and necessary for me to do.
I mean, your beautiful heart is reminding other people, probably of every kind of shape, religion, creed, whatever you have, reminding them that they have beautiful hearts and that they can show up in the world with their authentic selves, and that it is a good thing.
It's a good thing.
It is a good thing to be open to others, to have your heart be open, to do the work of the heart, because really, I think a lot of people need to do a lot of work on their hearts and their stories that their hearts are holding. Because, I don't think a lot of people know that. I mean, I do believe, the gut brain access, of course. I mean, we have a lot of different intelligences within our bodies, but at the center of it all, in this beautiful place that kind of is between the gut and the brain, is the heart. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think that's the ground of all. And what does it look like to be in deep communion with the heart? We need more of that.
That's true. I would definitely agree with you.
Thanks everyone for listening to this episode of the podcast and my really interesting and fun conversation with Gloria. Not only did she kind of captivate me with her mathematics, with math, but also the conversation around psychology and how we can help men to become their bigger, brighter, more authentic selves. To check out a little bit more of what Gloria is doing in the world, there will be a link in the episode show notes. So do yourself a favor and click that link. Thanks to everyone who listens. You know the way to my heart, ratings and reviews. This work is a work of love, of passion, but I like to get ratings. I like to get reviews. I love to know that people are out there listening to the pod. So if you find the time to do either, I would be ever so grateful. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Gloria. Be unstoppable. If you see a problem out there and you think, oh, I might be able to help with this, or oh, maybe I can show up for this person, whether it's a friend or a stranger or even your company, your boss, whatever that looks like. I mean, we all know it takes a village to make this world more shiny, brighter, more sparkly with good feeling. See the need in your community and then show up for it. Be like Gloria, and despite the overwhelming odds of making a pivotal change in society, of creating
a positive force for good in the world. Even though the odds might seem insurmountable, just take that first step. Because you never know where that first step is going to lead. And once you get working on this issue, or once you start showing up for whoever it is that you're showing up for, I bet you'll get a lot of energy and you'll feel like the winds of inspiration are carrying you. So take that first step, like Gloria, and show up for people who need you. And you never know, at the end of the day, what kind of beauty and what kind of goodness you're going to contribute to this world. And I think that makes it exciting, don't you? Okay, Gloria, are you the best person ever and the best conversationalist? And I'm just smitten now.
I'm just me, and I've enjoyed being connected to you because it does feel like a genuine connection.
It does. I agree. I was thinking this entire time that I want you to put me in your pocket and take me home.
That's a great image. That's going to show up in a blog sometime.
Okay, good, good, good. I mean, I just am so enamored of you and your spirit and its kind of indefatigability. That's and how I think one of the things I'm thinking is, how could you ever, I mean, this is big work you're doing. This is work that on days, certain days, it might seem insurmountable. It might feel like Sisyphus rolling the boulder up the mountain. But you've had this experience when you were little. And why wouldn't that give you hope, infinite hope for all eternity, that you can keep going? And what a massive gift. And I'm so grateful that you're in the world.
Well, thank you. I love the work that I do. And I just can't imagine ever stopping it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also want to thank you for indulging my whimsical kind of questions about math, because I just...
That was fun.
Yeah. I've recently had this revelation that my brain just works a little differently. So I see everything in three dimensions, which is hard to explain to people. So when people talk about math, I can see the numbers, but then some part of my brain goes out three dimensionally into the world. And it's very challenging to explain to people what that's like. But I recently had this revelation. I was watching this show on Primes, and I love Primes because they're so mysterious and they're so interesting. And they kind of both allude to the chaotic nature of the universe, but also that there is no chaos. So it's very fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were talking about the mystery behind Primes. And I thought to myself, well, why don't they create a three-dimensional model and create kind of a cone or an unraveling in that way, and see if the Primes form any shapes or are out there in the world in a way where you're like, oh, this, there is a pattern here. And then I found out a mathematician did it like 200 years ago. So I was like, okay. So my brain works differently. I mean, it's so hard to explain, but with that understanding comes a lot of reconciliation for my poor child brain and how I, you know, tried to navigate the world as a kid. And I'm like, I literally don't understand this place, but now I know why. It's just,
now you know why.
Yes. Right. Yes. So, you've reached me at this really interesting crossroads where I'm gaining a greater sense of self and, feel like I have permission now to be that self in the world, if that makes any sense. And I think it's because of the work you do, you know, you're giving men permission to access parts of themselves that might seem so hard to reach, but with your work and your support and your kindness and empathy and brilliance, you're allowing them to step into their true selves. And that is a big thing.
That is a very big thing. Stepping into reality is powerful.
I love it.